This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. This episode is sponsored by a company I've literally been using for over 15 years now, and that is 5.11. Now, my introduction to their products began when I started wearing 5.11 uniforms years ago for Anaheim Fire Department. And since then, I have acquired a host of their backpacks and luggage, which have literally been around the world with me. The backpack where I keep all my recording equipment is a 5.11 backpack. And then most of my civilian gear, the clothes that I wear, are also 5.11. Now, more recently, they've actually branched out into the brick and mortar stores. So, for example, Gainesville, where I do jiu-jitsu, has a beautiful 5.11 store. So if you are a fire department, a law enforcement agency, you now have access to an entire inventory of clothing and equipment in these 5.11 stores. Now, I've talked about the range of shoes they have and how important minimizing weight in our footwear is when it comes to our back health, knee health, etc. I've talked about their unique uniforms that are fitted for either male or female first responders. And then I want to highlight one new area, their CloudStrike packs. For those of you who enjoy hiking, this would even be an application, I believe, for the wildland community. They've created an ultralight pack now with a hydration system built in for rucking, running, or other long-distance events. Now, as always, 5.11 is offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, 15% off every purchase that you make. So if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, at 511tactical.com, you will get that 15% off every single time. So if you want to hear more about 5.11 and their origin story, go to episode 338 of Behind the Shield podcast with their CEO, Francisco Morales. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week we are addressing such a raw and important conversation. My guest is Bethel Kagan, and her husband Frank was a 30-year veteran of the Florida Fire Service. In the last year of his life, Bethel watched Frank slowly unravel, which ultimately resulted in his suicide. So this is a visceral perspective through the eyes of a loved one when a first responder is in crisis. And we discuss a host of topics, from his journey into the fire service, his love of martial arts, the psychosis that began to manifest, the negative side of psychiatric meds and Baker Act, the haunting red flags, the change Bethel wants to make in the American Fire Service, and so much more. Now, before we get to this heartbreaking conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Bethel Kagan. Enjoy. Well, Bethel, I want to start by saying thank you so much for reaching out initially and now taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate you giving me this opportunity to be in your podcast. Like what I had said before, initially when we first spoken, I'm just a stay-at-home mom. I was married to my husband for 20 years. We've been together for 21. And, you know, he was the one that was always in the forefront. And I was just home taking care of the kids, stay-at-home mom. You know, somehow I got thrust into this after he passed away. So it's an honor. I appreciate you. Thank you, James. And thank you for all your work.
Well, I think it's important. You know, when we lose people, we can either just say, oh, that's sad, shrug our shoulders and keep doing the same thing. Or we can at least figure out, is there an opportunity to learn from that and prevent it happening in the future?
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I'm trying to turn my pain into a purpose. And somehow, hopefully, throughout all this, I can be a voice, or even if I can just help save someone or maybe change their perspective, right, on like ending their life or anything like that, or even thinking about ending their life by hearing this episode or any of your shows, for that matter, I think it's quite important.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. Well, very first question then, where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
I live here in South Florida, West Broward County, in Pembroke Pines. Sunny South Florida.
I was in Pines when I worked for Hialeah. That's where I live. My house is in Pines.
Really? Yeah, I'm in West Pines. It has completely changed now.
I'm sure. I think I was off 187th. And I think if you went three more streets, you hit the Everglades. And I'm sure there's probably a lot more construction there.
All the way out west. I'm between, well, I'm on 172nd.
Okay. So yeah, not too far. So I would love to start at the very beginning of your journey. Obviously, we'll walk through to when you and Frank met, and then we'll kind of move forward from there. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
Okay, I was born in the Philippines, originally Iloilo City. We moved here in 93, so I kind of half grew up in the Philippines and pretty much like grew up here then. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad was a captain of the cargo ship. So he traveled a lot, and my mom would also go with him on the cargo ship to, you know, be with him and stuff. So I grew up with my cousins and my aunts and uncles in the Philippines and our grandmother, and they pretty much kind of like raised us. And then we moved here in the States in 93. So there's five of us in total. I'm number three out of five.
I'm one of five as well, funny enough. But my wife is actually half Filipino. I just spent a week with my in-laws, and her mother is from the Philippines.
Oh, wow. Where we're at?
I can't remember. Because I know it's so many little islands. I forget. It wasn't Manila. It was somewhere more rural, I believe. So talk to me about the immigration story then, your parents' perspective, and then, you know, your own unique perspective. Because I think I talk about this a lot. You know, when you hear the word immigrant these days, it's almost like a nasty word. You know, then they're talking about illegals and borders and walls and stuff like that. But this whole country, you know, aside from the Native Americans, and even then, if you go far enough back, they were from Asia. But, you know, this whole nation was built on immigration. And I think there are some beautiful stories mixed into the fabric of this nation. So what were the highs of your immigration and your parents' immigration story? And were there any lows?
Well, actually, my parents, my dad, my mom and dad, we actually had to get a lawyer and spend a lot of money in order for us to move here and to be with them. So, you know, they worked hard. My dad, when he stopped working for the cargo ship, there were times when he had to work at the farm down here in Miami just to earn a living and then save their money. So did my mom. My mom would work as a caretaker for the elderly, and they sacrificed a lot to bring us over here. And they went through the legal way as far as, you know, getting a lawyer and getting all our paperwork done. we got denied several times when we were in the Philippines trying to come here. I remember as young as 5 years old, getting all our paperwork done, going to the consulate in the Philippines over there, standing in line for hours just so we could come here in the United States. And thankfully, through the grace of God, you know, like I think in 93, that's when we finally got approved for a visa to come here and move here. And yeah, it cost my parents a lot of money to have us here. And this is the greatest country in the world.
So what part of the States did you move into initially? Was it South Florida immediately?
Yes, here. South Florida, Plantation, Florida.
And what made them choose that part of the States?
I think at the time, my dad's family lived in Miami, and my dad had a business in Port Everglades, which is by Fort Lauderdale. So Plantation was like, you know, the up and coming suburb at the time before Pines. So it was like a great community, and he purchased a home there, and that's where we lived until I met my husband, Frank.
So what about sports when you were at school age? What were you playing?
Oh my gosh, no, I did not play sports. I was not into sports. I guess growing up in the Philippines, it was a little bit different back then when I was growing up, because we did not play sports. It was almost like you want to be inside a house. You don't want to be out in the sun and stuff like that. It's just like, you know, you want to be girly kind of. So yeah, I couldn't play sports, did not play sports. It was almost unheard of for girls to play sports back then. I mean, I'm sure it has changed now, but yeah. Did not play sports. I did not dabble into sports or any of that stuff, physical activities, until I was in my 20s.
What about nutrition? How does the food that you were raised on in the Philippines contrast to the food that you found yourself immersed in the States?
Over there in the Philippines, we ate rice. Rice is like the staple. So breakfast, lunch, and dinner, we had rice, and rice with everything, pretty much. It was, you know, we had like stew, soup, and everything else. Like over here, you have a lot more prepackaged meals, I guess. But over there, it was like fresh food, and you know, it was prepared for you for breakfast. You get like a fresh batch of rice with eggs, meat, and stuff like that. As opposed to over here, you eat like cereal or sandwich or, you know, breakfast sandwich. But yeah, over there, it's just like a heavy laden, like good food.
Yeah, I got exposed to some of that when I was over there. Her mom's a great cook. So pancit.
Yeah. So it's different.
Now, what about career aspirations? As you were going through the school system, what were you dreaming of becoming?
Quite honestly, I was always that child that didn't know what I wanted. I was like the dreamer, I guess. Like, I'll dabble on the idea of, okay, I want to be a teacher. At one point, I wanted to be a nun. You know, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grow up. And I'm still trying to figure that out, to be honest. I'm like one of those people that are like, okay, wherever it may be or whatever it may be, maybe someday it'll just come to me. And I've been blessed in that, I guess, aspect, because, you know, I just go with the flow.
Well, let's walk back in time again to Frank's upbringing. So tell me where he was born, and tell me a little bit about his family as well.
Okay, my husband was Frank, was born in Islip, New York, and I believe they moved here when he was 7, maybe, because his dad had relocated for his job. So the whole family moved here, I think, when he was 7 years old, and they moved here in Pembroke Pines at the time, and he's been here since. And his dad is from the Caribbean, from St. Martin, and his mom is from New York. He's like New York, American, Italian.
Now, what? Same question again. I'm sure it's probably rare if you have this kind of conversations, but have you heard any of their immigration stories, or his dad's specifically?
All I know is, like, you know, obviously I think his dad moved here when he was like 19 or 20, and he started working immediately from the Caribbean, from St. Martin. And I think he started working at the bakery. I think he stayed with his uncle, but I can't really speak for him because, you know, obviously my version would be all mixed up and it may be wrong, so I don't want to speak for him. Yeah, but his mom on the other side, I think she's a second or third generation American Italian.
Okay, beautiful. Yeah. Well, then what about Frank's journey into the fire service? You ever talked to him about why he joined in the first place?
Well, I think I just, you know, I'm so thankful because when he was in high school, he was dating this girl, Dawn, and her father worked for the fire department in Miami-Dade, and he dated for, you know, a few years. They were like childhood sweethearts. And I think he got inspired by his girlfriend's dad, and that's how he got started in the fire department. So I'm really thankful for her family, for her and her family, because we're still friends, and she's an amazing woman.
So he joined his department in 1989, have I got that right?
Yes.
Okay. So yeah. Walk me through, you know, what you know of his kind of career before you met him, and then let's get to when you guys met.
Well, I mean, he started really, really young. And I guess, you know, while he was in the fire department, he would be a personal trainer on the side. He also worked for an ambulance company. He also worked for, I think it was one of those air rescue things. I think that's what he said before. So he worked at all those places prior to meeting me, and he would also teach CPR classes and stuff like that while he was single. Frank was 12 years older than me, so he had a really colorful life prior to meeting me, or I guess prior to settling down. So he had a lot of like little odd jobs here and there. But all in all, though, at the end of the day, he loved being a firefighter. That was his life. That's who he was, and he was so passionate about his career.
There's so many elements that contribute to what we're going to talk about later, you know, someone reaching an emotional crisis. Right. And after all these conversations that I had, you know, the impact of our early years, our formative years on our emotional resilience later in life is undeniable, you know, and that trauma can be absolutely horrific, like a sexual abuse, or it can be, you know, something seemingly less traumatic, but still had a huge impact on that young man or woman. When you've had conversations with him, were there any elements of his earlier life that you think added to what ultimately happened?
Quite honestly, no, not really. I just feel like, you know, he was a hardworking man. He was sensitive, for sure. He was empathetic. So maybe perhaps that attributed, you know, to the whole career of like accumulation of the job of what you see on calls, like for 30 years, it's a total accumulation of different things that happen. And obviously in the fire service or first responder community, I mean, hopefully it changes now. Back then, you can't really speak about your feelings or going to a call or anything like that. It's almost like you're not man enough or you're a PSSY. I don't know if I can say that.
No, you can say anything on here, just so you know.
You know, so it like back then, it's almost like you're a pussy if you speak about your feelings or if it bothers you a little bit. So I believe like it's just an accumulation of things that occurred. But I mean, he was very sensitive. I know he was a sensitive person. One of the most, like, he looked tough. He was a tough guy, but he was definitely a sensitive man.
And was he into the martial arts and boxing before you guys met?
Yeah, he already was. Yeah.
And he was a Golden Gloves champion at one point as well.
He was a Golden Glove champion. He even did Tough Man when Tough Man was around. He did that too. He also dabbled into jiu-jitsu and MMA, like striking and boxing and, yeah, kickboxing and stuff. So he was into all that stuff. He was one of the toughest men I've known.
Was he training with Wagner Rocha?
Yes, he was. We were with Wagner for a while.
Okay, because it's funny, that's actually the father gym of my gym in Gainesville, Swamp Academy. That's who gave my instructor his black belt.
Oh, wow, yeah. So Frank was Wagner Rocha's competitor of the year. I think that was 2014, in 2014, because Frank loved to compete. He was very competitive. So Wagner awarded him as competitor of the year at the gym.
Amazing.
Yeah, and he started jiu-jitsu quite late. He started, I think he was 44 or 45.
Brilliant. All right, well, let's go back to when you guys met then. Walk me through, you know, kind of the first time meeting and then your kind of, you know, honeymoon period, as it were.
Okay, well, I guess we didn't really meet me. So I was working at Hooters back in 99. I picked up a shift over there. It was Air and Sea Show. And I just remembered it was a busy day that day at the beach place. And I was in one corner of the room. I had my own section. And I heard like a bunch of like, you know, loud guys in one corner of the room, and I just ignored it, whatever. And then 2 years later, in 2001, my girlfriend and I and my cousin went to an event at the Bank Atlantic Center at the time in Sunrise. And my girlfriend and Frank's friend were working a detail. And Kevin was like, he started talking to my girlfriend Marissa, because I guess it was like four young girls at this event, and it's like a Christian like event, and mostly it was older people that goes to this event. So he started talking to my girlfriend, and we went to our section. He calls Frank immediately and told Frank, oh, I think you're going to like this girl. There's this girl that I want you to meet. She's here with her friends, whatever. So during like one of the intermission, we went outside of our section, and then Frank was out there. We got introduced, and that was January of 2001. And ever since then, we've been together. And Frank was looking, when we were dating, Frank was looking through some of the pictures, and he saw me in my Hooters uniform with really short hair at the time, too. He's like, I remembered you back at the Air and Sea show. He's like, that was you. And he described to me exactly to the T, like where I was that day and what I was doing. And I still remembered, because I was just like, oh my gosh, these people are just so loud. I was just feeling overwhelmed at the time. And I'm like, yeah, I was working that day. He's like, yeah. He's like, I was there. I remember you specifically. So I just thought it was weird and fate.
Were the loud people all firefighters?
Yeah, that was him and his friends.
I figured.
Said, yeah, they were so loud. But he said that he was running on A1A. So he was going for a jog, and they were already up there. So he went upstairs to meet them, and he saw me on the other side of the room.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, with the timeline then, I know in 2002, he won Firefighter of the Year. So walk me through, you know, the rescue and what happened prior to that.
Well, actually, we were just dating then. So he was like telling me this story that he said, you know, that he rescued this woman and stuff. But like at the time, it was just to me, I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. Like, you're Firefighter of the Year, great, whatever. And I'm just like brushed it off. I didn't realize it was such a big deal. So it was like, oh, okay, that was nice. I mean, lovely, brilliant, great. But yeah, he was pretty proud of that moment. He went to a call and then, you know, found this woman unresponsive. And I guess there was like a fire and there was a thick smoke and saved her. But to me, I wasn't really paying attention. To me at the time, I was like, whatever. Like, impressive, sure. But, you know, I was like, whatever. Now I wish I paid more attention, but
so as you guys met, he's about what, 10, just over 10 years into his career then. So, you know, retrospectively now with this, you know, sadly widow's lens that you have, where was he mentally at that point?
He was good until about 2019, when really I noticed a behavior change. It was like completely like a 360 in 2019, where I was like, this is not the man I know. I mean, there were moments where I was like, okay, he's acting a little bit obsessive. But then again, to me, Frank was like such, he was focused. He had tunnel vision. And if he wants to do something, everything else doesn't matter. And he just focuses on that task until he achieves it. He was an overachiever. And he did achieve whatever he wanted to put his mind, like, to get or achieve or whatever, right? So in 2019, he just started saying things that did not make sense anymore. And his behavior was a little bit erratic. And I'm like, okay, he's not okay anymore. Like, we're having a crisis here. So 2019 was really, like, the big year of the shit show, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because we do such a good job of hiding it, you know, and this is what's so sad is you hear a lot of people, and it's two things. It's, I felt like I was weak and everyone else seemed to be fine. And actually, if you climb inside someone else's head, they're thinking exactly the same thing, looking back at the person who was thinking that. So, you know, in this profession, we have to wear a mask. You know, if we're on a call and it's a life or death incident, you can't be showing your emotions on your face. It's just going to freak the patient out. So you have to have that. But the problem is, some of us are so good at hiding it. The number of times that I've heard the comment, oh, that was the last person I expected to do that. Well, that's because they just hit it well.
It's true. I mean, he had a great poker face. You look at him, you would think that nothing bothered him. just the way he carried himself and the way he looked and just even responding to calls. Everybody loved him because he was such a pillar in his work, in the department that he worked for. You know, he had achieved a lot and he proved it too. So he walked the walk and talked the talk and everyone looked up to him. And the way he just carried himself, it was, he was just a symbol of strength, pretty much. And 2019, that's when he just unraveled very quickly too.
Well, let's go back just so that we kind of paint the kind of father he was as well. So talk to me about the birth of the two children.
Oh, Frank wanted to choose the sex of our baby when we first got together. And he's very tunnel vision. He was a planner. He wanted things a certain way. And I was just like, whatever. He talked me into having kids because I didn't want to have kids at first. I'm like, I don't want kids because I have two younger sisters and I help raise my younger sisters. So I was like, I'm still young. I don't want kids. And he's like, no, it's going to be perfect. I waited so long. I'm like, you know what? Yeah, I do love you. Why not? So he researched, he read the book, How to Choose the Sex of Your Baby, and he wanted a son at first, just like all men does, like, right? Like, firstborn should be a son, so like, can take care of your daughter, of the sister, and be like a protector or whatever. You want a junior. So he tried to research about that. Obviously, that didn't work out. We had a girl. And then we had Frankie 4 years later, but Frank was an amazing father. He was the greatest dad to our kids. Amazing, amazing dad. That I'm so blessed to have him as my partner and to be the father of our children.
Beautiful. He obviously wasn't paying attention at the reproduction chapter of his biology class in high school, though.
Yeah, but, you know, God blessed us with a girl first, so yeah.
Beautiful. Well, while he's, you know, going through that age now, you've met, you're having children. Talk to me about the frequency that he was at work. I mean, were they well staffed? Were there any kind of, you know, forced overtime, or was he volunteering for extra work? Just because, I mean, this is something that I talk about a lot. One of the pieces of the puzzle of mental health is obviously sleep deprivation, and that can factor in as well.
No, actually, we're very lucky because the department that you work for, you know, there was no issue with forced overtime, really. They were well staffed. So Frank was, you know, there were overtimes available, but it wasn't like he was forced. Not unless there's like, you know, a hurricane or anything like that where, okay, it's mandatory. But he was never forced. There was never like a forced overtime for the department that he worked for. So he had a good work balance there at the time.
Excellent. So then let's walk through to 2019 then. So you've got, you know, this husband, this father, this respected firefighter, this respected martial artist, and he seems to be thriving. Talk to me about the beginning of that unraveling in 2019.
Well, actually, throughout his career in Sunrise, so he started also veering towards the politics side of, you know, the department as well. So he was also the union president for their department in that, for the city of Sunrise Fire Department. So he was the union president and he also got involved in the pension. So he was first, I guess, like a board member for the pension board for the fire department. And then he eventually became a chairman. So he was in that position for a long time. And in 2019, when we started seeing him unravel slowly, it was like he started talking a lot about the numbers and something was wrong. There's corruption and all that stuff. And that's when we were like, okay, something's not right here. And he was very adamant about something that he found in the pension and all that stuff, which to me, he's never spoken about stuff like that before. And what he was saying just did not make sense to me. And he wasn't sleeping as well. And he was just borderline. He had psychosis pretty much because he was saying that, you know, Sunrise was out to get him. The city was out to get him. I was working for the city and the city controlled me. And that, you know, he was going to meet the president. At the time, it was Trump. The president was going to come down here and meet him. DeSantis was going to come and meet him. And he was going to write a bill for the Senate. It was just like a big jumbo of different things that he was just, his mind was just going 1,000 miles an hour. Nothing made sense to me. anymore. And that's, I'm like, okay, something's wrong.
So how did that start affecting you, the kids, his work life? You know, talk to me about the kind of ripple effect of this trauma that was going on in his own mind.
Well, initially, I tried to be as supportive as I can, because obviously I'm not involved in his work. I don't know, or back then, I did not know the inner workings of the pension board. I did not know the inner workings of the union work, so, and the politics as well. So I was like, okay, I'll hear you out and hear what you have to say. And I tried to be as understanding as possible. But when he started rambling things off and accusing me of working for the city, and, you know, that this city's got to me and they're paying me, and I was talking to different people from the city, I'm like, that's not true. I'm not doing that. I'm here at home taking care of you and the kids. We're so busy. You know, I'm so busy trying to take care of the household and our children, their after school activities. You know, I'm like, that's not true at all. And he was so insistent and adamant about that, that I'm like, okay, this is not right. It's not making sense. And what you're telling me is not making sense as well. And you don't have proof. Like, I was asking him for proof, because obviously I believe him. He's my husband. But he just kept saying things and just telling me all these things. I'm like, I understand that. Let's take one step at a time. Okay, if you think you have something on this company, break it down for me. Let's talk it through and just slow it down. But he was also speaking like 1,000 miles per hour. And nothing he said would make sense. It was like almost like a run-on sentence of just one thing after another. And he wasn't sleeping. So he was just nothing made sense. It was like, it was kind of scary, but I had to find a composure, I guess, to deal with him and just settle everything down. Because if I would have fought with him at the time, it would have been like a shit show and I wouldn't be able to get through the bottom of things. So I tried to like stay back as long as I could, until I knew that, okay, something is like, when I had the, I guess like a sign that, okay, he's not well, he's going off, he's doing random things, I can't get a hold of him. That's when I really got scared.
And what ended up having to happen? Because I mean, this is, I think, an important conversation. There's, you know, so many levels, from, you know, suicide to psychosis to even homicide. I just interviewed a firefighter from California when they had that murder suicide in their station. And it's all, you know, related to the same thing. It's a psychosis. But, you know, there can be an outward projection on the family. There can be a point where the husband or the wife and the children don't feel safe anymore.
Right. Well, when Frank actually, so he started not sleeping a lot. And he was just like telling me that, you know, what scared me the most was him saying that the SWAT team was going to come to our house and that they were going to all kill us. And that's when I'm like, okay, this is not normal anymore. It's not normal behavior that you're actually even thinking of that. So I was telling him, I'm like, either you move out or I move out. Because I did not feel safe anymore, because nothing made sense. What he was saying was not making sense. He was not sleeping. He was driving all over the place. I couldn't get a hold of him. He would block me. And he just seemed to like see me as a person that worked for the city, and he hated the city at the time. So I couldn't even speak to him one-on-one, because everything he said to me was like accusatory that I was the enemy. And, you know, I was worried for our children too. He, not once has he ever been like physically abusive towards me. Ever, our whole entire marriage. Even then, I did not feel like I did not feel a threat, but the psychosis scared me. Like, his eyes changed, the way he spoke to me changed, the way he would speak to our daughter changed. It was almost like a different person. And, you know, he would talk to strangers for like hours. He would call the cops. He would call 911 and tell them to send the news here over our house, because he said that he had something against the city. So it was a very tough time. I didn't know what was going on as well, but I was just trying to survive, because it was chaotic. It was complete chaos, pretty much. Because he was also Baker acted. I mean, yeah, he was Baker acted quite a few times before all this shit happened.
Well, I think this is, you know, it's so important to have this conversation. I want to get to something I've heard from a lot of people that have been right there, not so much in the psychosis state, but certainly in the suicidal state. But before we even do, putting that compassion back into events like this, when you realize that someone's entire reality has been shifted. So you and I believe that it's normal that we're sitting in our respective rooms in front of a computer talking to a microphone. That's our reality. You know, but if I look out the window and I see Russians marching down the road, and that's truly what my brain is telling me is the truth, then from the outside, I'm going to seem like a crazy person. So, you know, just when you realize that these people are sick, they are broken, and I mean that in a compassionate way, then you can actually view it with a much more empathetic lens. But if we're just like, oh, what's wrong with him? You know, he's a piece of shit now. Then you never get to the root cause of, you know, why. Instead of saying what's wrong with you, you say, you know, what happened to you? How have you got to this point, and how do we pull you back from it?
I completely agree. I think that was the problem initially, right? Because, you know, he was saying all these things and we were like, what is wrong with you? That's not true. And I think that was partly, I blame myself. I wish I knew now. I think me asking him what's wrong with you instead of trying to help him navigate, you know, his way through hell, I guess that kind of made things worse at the time, because it was like he clearly needed help. He was psychotic, but it was almost like me not knowing what I was doing, kind of just like we butt heads, because I just wanted to just make him stop. And he wanted to express something that he thought in you. And I was trying to like also argue with him that what he saw or what he thought was not true. And I wish, you know, I wish we have resources for stuff like that in school for our kids or just every day. I think that kind of things needs to be like in our society. We need to talk more about that. Be empathetic, be kind, and be compassionate, especially when it comes to mental illness. Because you're right. When you're mentally ill, that's what your brain's telling you, so you believe it. Unfortunately, we're not taught that at school or anywhere else. And you, like, it's a little too late for me now to, you know, to learn that. But I mean, moving forward, now I do. But when my husband was going through that, that was really tough, because I've never dealt with anything like that ever.
What was the impact of the Baker Act on his behavior? The reason I asked that, firstly, I had a horrendous experience with my son when he was younger that actually was Baker Acted against, you know, for no reason basically whatsoever, other than he was just sad. He was going through some stuff in his mother's house and was crying in class. But that particular moment, the SRO and the principal made a fucking horrendous, you know, decision, mistake, that now they've changed the law. They'd be locked up for doing the same thing. They basically kidnapped my child. So I saw the impact of that on him. I mean, that trauma lasted years. I mean, you know, arguably till today. But I've had people in the psychology world on here as well that say that, you know, even the science shows that the Baker Act actually makes it worse, not better. So what was your perspective of him and that experience?
In some ways, because he was so psychotic and he was so out of control, selfishly for us, it was almost like a relief, because he's not driving around, not getting into trouble, not doing things that he's not supposed to be doing. And we're like, okay, he's in a controlled environment. But for him at the time, I did see how it made it worse. It made him angrier. It made him feel less of a man. And I'm sure it gave him PTSD for sure. I know it did, because he would tell me, and he did tell me how it made things worse for him, especially just before he passed away, because he was in the hospital for almost a month just before he passed away. And he said he never, ever wanted to go back at the hospital setting ever again. And he said that last stay at the hospital broke him. It did. He said it's horrible. And I'm just obviously relaying what he said to me.
Yeah. What about the sense of burdensome? The thing that I've heard, I touched on before, from so many people that you don't hear in mental health conversations, again, when that brain has been miswired. So now what's real to them from the outside looking in doesn't make any sense to us. But they truly find that themselves at a point where they believe that they are a burden to their family, to their wife or husband, to their children. And therefore, suicide actually becomes a courageous, selfless act, and contrary to all the judgmental comments that people have usually. And because a healthy brain is trying to understand what an unhealthy brain has done. Did he ever kind of mention seeming like he was a burden to you guys?
Every day he would tell me. Every day he would tell me. He would tell me that we were better off without him here. And he was embarrassed and what he had put us through. He was embarrassed for our kids. He was embarrassed for me. And he was sorry for everything that he had done. And he thought that our life will be better off without him.
See, and this is a problem. If we try and hang on to that old way of looking at it, all we're doing is adding more guilt and more shame to someone who's drowning in guilt and shame.
Absolutely. And, you know, for him, he was a 30-year firefighter. So he was also forced to resign from his position because obviously when he was manic, he wasn't following protocols because he was in the right frame of mind. So when they had told him to go for a fitness evaluation, you know, he wouldn't do it. He thought nothing was wrong with him and that we were all stupid. He was a genius. He was above the law. So when he was forced to resign, I think it broke him. He was also in jail. So he got arrested as well. My husband was spent time at the North Broward jail for a few months because he was recording his phone conversation with the fire chief and I think it, at the time the assistant city manager and posted it on Facebook without informing them. So he got those charges and I had also had to file a restraining order against him because he started staying at a hotel with a random stranger at the time. And like I said, he thought that was working for the city and he was just so out of control. I couldn't get a hold of him. I didn't know who the guy was and everything. The guy was using him as, you know, a free meal pretty much. And the guy said that he was sent by Jesus and would pray over him. And Frank thought that he was sent by God and he was a minister. So he was his spiritual advisor. That's what he had told me. So I didn't trust the guy. I didn't trust what he was trying to tell Frank. In my head, I got paranoid. I'm like, what if he told Frank to kill me? Or, you know, just I just didn't know who this person was. So when Frank posted the videos, he got charges for that. And then when when he broke the injunction, he got arrested for that. And then he spent time in jail. But luckily, his case got transferred to mental health court, where he was ordered to go down to Miami and to spend some time there at the facility. And that's where he kind of started coming down from his mania. Because even in jail, he was quite manic and he was in isolation. He had to wear the red jumpsuit when I had to see him in court. So he was that severe.
What? I can see how obviously the department's hands would be tied if this was, you know, what was going on. And I totally understand that. But looking back at it now, you have someone who's already in crisis and then their tribe is stripped for them, that their purpose, their identity. I mean, he was a proud firefighter. And we have this with people that, you know, retire with somewhat good mental health compared to, you know, what was Frank was enduring at that point. And it crushes them, you know, being taken that bay door closing for the last time. And now you're not on that rig. You're not in that station. So again, with hindsight being 2020, there may not be, you know, an opportunity to keep him employed, or maybe there would be an opportunity to just kind of hit the pause button on the whole thing. But understanding that when we do terminate someone who's struggling, again, we're adding even more trauma to that person because their healing tribe was the people that they worked with in uniform. And now you've snatched that from them. And again, it might be justified, it might not, but it's still something for us to acknowledge.
Absolutely. I truly believe, like I said, I totally understand where the department was coming from. Their hands were tied. They felt like maybe their back was against the wall. And, you know, what happened to Frank was the first time that has ever happened in that department ever. And here's this man who was a pillar within their department, who was a union president, 30-year, you know, one of the 30-year employee, a captain, you know, he was pretty much the guy over there that everybody looked up to. And it was unfortunate what happened. I see both sides, and I don't really blame them, because obviously a lot has to play into it, but I wish it could have been better, for sure. Absolutely. There could have maybe been other ways, you know, but then their backs were tied too, and their hands were tied, and their backs were against the wall. So it was a very complicated, I guess, situation. But I do hope moving forward, you know, I do think that they have learned what not to do, and use Frank's, what happened to Frank is like, you know, I guess, an example of what not to do for whomever may be in crisis next time.
Yeah. Before we kind of progress on, Frank had pretty much hit 30 years. Had you discussed retirement, or was he still planning on working for a while yet?
Yeah. So, because Frank was, he had a plan. He was a planner. He wanted to see things a certain way, and he always accomplished whatever he had in his checklist. So he had 2 years left. He was already in the drop, so he had 2 years left. So he wanted to finish the whole 7 year, because they had a 7 year drop at the time. And for him, like after he retired, he wanted to still work. He wanted to maybe perhaps dabble into consulting, because he was really good with numbers, and he was also in the pension board. So he loved math. He loved numbers. And he wanted to also buy a property, well, build a property in St. Martin and have that as like, you know, an Airbnb and just go back and forth and travel the world. That's what he wanted to do. Like, we were supposed to enjoy retirement, be his own boss, and do consulting and travel the world and have rental properties as well. That was his goal. That was the ultimate goal that he wanted to do, because he was fairly young.
Yeah. Now, this makes it even more tragic. I mean, he was almost there when this all kind of started cascading down.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's what hurt him, because everything that he had worked hard for all his life just pretty much came crashing around him. He didn't have the retirement he wanted. He didn't leave the city that he worked for, the fire department that he worked for, in his own terms. And he left with feeling the stigma of him being sick, being so manic, and that's what he was like. So embarrassed about, and so afraid that people will remember him in that capacity instead of the good things that he did for the residents, for his brothers and sisters in the department.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to change that perspective.
Well, even the element of organizational betrayal, which may not have been, you know, deliberate in this particular case, but it was certainly perceived in the way that he viewed it. You wear that, you know, that patch on your shoulder, that's who you protect. Again, it's your tribe, but it's, you know, it's everything. And then if they turn their backs on you, or you perceive that they turn their backs on you, that's yet another layer to this Jenga, you know, kind of mental health model that we're talking about.
Oh, definitely. He thought that they turned their backs on him. Like I had told him, I'm like, it's not that they turned their back on you. Their hands were tied. Their back was against the wall. I had to be in the middle, and I had to look at it in a realistic way as well. Of course, I want to take my husband's side, but at the same time, I'm a realist, and I saw where they were coming from, the other side of the spectrum as well. So even though, yes, these are your friends, they also have a job to do. They had to make sure also, like, they go by protocol and all that stuff. I just wish there was other ways into doing that. And, you know, we could have prolonged him until he was a little bit better for them to force him into retirement.
Absolutely. All right. Well, then let's talk about March 29th, 2022.
Unfortunately, that was the day that Frank decided to take his life. I found him. And I wish that they had never left the house. I think he decided to like take his life maybe right after I left the house to go to the store. That morning, he was just discharged from the hospital a week before that. So that morning, I was just telling him to get up because he was just laying in bed. He did not want to get up. He was Baker acted a month before that because that's what he would just do. He was just so depressed. He did not want to get up. So I told him that morning when I came home after I dropped off our son, I was like, okay, you need to get up now. You can't just lay in bed. You did this before and look what happened. You were Baker acted. I'm like, I think we have to change things. And he didn't want to get up. So I started crying and getting very frustrated with him because I just felt like the world was closing in. I didn't know what to do anymore. He was just at the hospital for a month. And then I'm like, what do we do? Please get up, get up. Let's go for a walk. He didn't feel like walking. He didn't want to do anything. And I started yelling and crying. And I'm like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. I'm like, you have to do something. You have to get up. So eventually he did get up, but I was upset. So I left the house. And when I came home, I heard him in the garage and I thought, okay, he's working out. So we were in the garage the night before working out. And I left him there. I'm like, okay, I'll just go to the store real quick. And then I'll come back and get him when it's time to pick up our son. I heard things in the garage, not thinking anything of it. I just thought that maybe, okay, he decided to go work out. So I left the house, and when I came back, when it was almost time to pick up our son, I found him. I was a little too late.
I'm so sorry to, you know, even get you to go back there in your mind, but I think it's just, it's so important that people hear the impact on the family and not maybe the person in crisis, because like I said, in their mind, they think they're doing something for their family. They think they're doing, you know, the right solution, but it's everyone else, all of us around, that should be looking out for our, you know, brothers and sisters that are struggling. And this is the impact. So what about the children? I mean, you found him. Talk to me about how the next few days and week went as far as, you know, telling your beloved kids and the rest of the family.
Well, that was like around, I came home like around maybe 1:20, 1:30. Our son, he school dismissal is at 2:00. And that's why I came home like around 1:30 because we would always pick him up from school because obviously he's retired now. So we would pick him up from school and we were never late. We're always there early. And at that time, when I found him, I had to call 911 and I didn't know what to do. Our daughter was at college at FSU, so she wasn't home. And I was just like so freaked out. I opened the garage door and a neighbor came and ran and called 911 and police came, fire rescue came, and obviously they had to pronounce him. And then I started freaking out. I'm like, my son, he's at school, and this time it was like around 2:15 maybe, and I think that's when he started getting worried because 2:00 we were not there. So I believe he started calling his sister over there in Tallahassee, and she was trying to call me and I couldn't talk to her, and I think that's when like he felt maybe something was wrong. But luckily one of the police officers had contacted the school and tried to find my son and just kept him in the guidance counselor's office, I think. And, you know, just they didn't say anything to him, I don't think. I think they just said something came up or whatever. And Kayla was just wondering what's going on. She was trying to FaceTime me, trying to find out what's going on. And eventually, like, I had to pick up. And that's when I told her that your dad's gone. That was... He was an amazing father, and that really broke my heart. Because I had to tell her on the phone, on FaceTime. And then picking up my son and telling him as well that his dad is gone. It's just... He said goodbye to his dad that morning. You know, I told him he loved him. Not knowing that was the last time. was tough.
It's horrendous. How as a family were you able to start navigating those first few weeks? I mean, talk to me about that road of grief that you had to go through.
I am so blessed and grateful for my family. My mom and my sisters immediately came the very next day. They flew in from Texas, and they were all here to just help us get through this. Kayla, my daughter, actually flew in that night from Tallahassee. And so, like, we just banded together, and just, like, family, just they just helped me so much. I'm just so blessed that I have a good family that they helped pick us up. We're very close, so that was a blessing.
Well, going back to Frank, had he tried counseling and some of these other things that we're told about initially?
Yes, he definitely did. He was seeing his therapist once a week, sometimes twice a week. He was diligent in taking all his medications. He was actually in the midst of doing his second round of ECT at the hospital. He went and did a CTT, an ECT Monday, and he passed away Tuesday. And that was, I believe, his fifth session of ECT. He was scheduled to go on a Wednesday, and March 29 was a Tuesday. So he was really diligent in doing all that stuff. But unfortunately, towards the end, it was just a treatment-resistant depression. And he just couldn't see himself getting better. Even at the hospital, when he was at the hospital for that 1 month, he thought that the city had sent an undercover officer for him over there. And he kept telling me that he thinks that he was going to spend the rest of his life in a state facility because he didn't see himself getting any better. We had talked about ketamine and other, you know, like, we didn't try ketamine, but he had mentioned ketamine to me, but he was hesitant about that too because he just felt so hopeless. He just didn't think anything would have helped by then.
Well, this is what's so sad. It's, of course, not a guarantee by any means, but the stigma around, you know, because of our drug prohibition laws that prevents first responders, military, medical people, etc., from accessing possibly the treatments that would have saved their lives. And the only reason I say that is I know, you know, I've had so many people on the show, I've got numerous friends that were at the absolute end of their rope. And it was an ayahuasca or an ibogaine or a ketamine, you know, therapy retreat that ultimately helped them turn the corner. And it's not a magic pill. They didn't just do one session and go, oh, I'm fine now. But it allowed them to access, you know, the thing beneath the thing, as they say, really, really kind of get to the genesis, or excuse me, the nucleus of their trauma, and then start unpacking it with the right kind of shaman, counselor, whoever it is that they've chosen.
Right.
But how many people have we lost because that was the last thing that they went, rather than that being one of the first thing that they're offered? And it, you know, right. if it's of the magnitude that clearly Frank was suffering from, then arguably maybe talk therapy wasn't the first, you know, the right go-to. Maybe it needed something a little deeper than that if he had that depth of depression and trauma.
I totally agree, absolutely. And it just still baffles me also with some of the medications that he was prescribed. I mean, some of them, it seemed like he was a zombie. It was just, he would be catatonic with some of the medications he was taking, or it wasn't doing anything for him at all. If anything, some of these medications made him worse too. So it was like a gamble as far as like prescribing him medications. He went through so many medications, and I don't know, like, I just feel so strongly about it because I feel like he would see a doctor and he would tell them his symptoms, or, you know, after a month or so of taking this medication, it's not working, blah, blah, blah. They will prescribe him a different medication, but there's no weaning off. They just tell him, okay, you can discontinue your current medication right now and start on this new one today or tomorrow. Well, what is it doing to your brain, your body chemistry? Like, that medication is still in your system. How can we just make them take this new medication without making sure that's out of your system? And then start the new one. How about we slowly start tapering off, not just start with this new medication. And sometimes they're like, you know, 500, 700 milligrams per tablet, and it's three times a day or something like that. Who does that? I just feel like it's an experiment, a science experiment on a person, on a human being, and it should be outlawed. It's just not right.
Well, two things. I've heard, you know, from a lot of people, a huge amount of people, including, you know, many, many people in the psychology space, that say, you know, the efficacy of these psych pills are basically almost equating to the, what do they call that? I just had the bloody word in my head and it fell out my placebo. So, you know, almost like a 50-50 flip a coin. And then the other thing that I've heard mentioned numerous times is that nearly all of the school shootings that we have, the shooter was on a psychiatric med. Now, you could argue, yeah, because they were mentally ill. You can look at it the other way and go, did that cause someone who was merely just depressed and turn them into psychotic? And the thing is, if you listen to a lot of the warning, you know, label speeches on these adverts of these pills, it says, you know, suicidal ideation, all these things, you know, may cause... all that. Well, this is supposed to be fixing it. Why is it causing it? You know, so I agree 100%. You know, if we're prescribing these pills, there is no doubt that that was, you know, a big part of turning someone who was merely anxious and or depressed and getting to that point of psychosis.
Right. I think it really attributed to that path, you know, even towards destruction almost, because you're so knee deep into the medication, and sometimes it completely numbs you and you're almost catatonic and you're physically here, but your mind, body, spiritual connection is almost gone because it's being numb by the medication. And you're just like, okay, well, maybe I'll just do this without really feeling and thinking anything anymore, because the medicine has completely stripped you of humanity almost. But that's just my...
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing is, if it's messing with your circadian rhythms, if it's affecting your sleep quality, well, that's another very kind of toxic, you know, element that you're not even really aware of. You know, you think you're asleep, but actually your sleep quality is terrible because you're on these psych meds, which are deliberately affecting your brain. So therefore, for example, some of the ones for ADHD, they're stimulants. If you're taking that, are you getting a deep, deep sleep? Or, you know, are you getting a very shallow sleep and you're waking up feeling like shit and you're a little bit more sleep deprived? And then, in a lot of our men and women then go and do a 24-hour shift, you know, and it could be that, it could be alcohol, it could be all kinds of things. But these are all the cumulative elements that contribute to some of our people having this perfect storm of psychosis or suicidal ideation.
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing also that he kept telling me was like, he couldn't sleep. He wasn't sleeping. That he barely slept. So I'm pretty sure even at the hospital, when he was at the hospital for that extended period of time for almost a month, he said he barely slept, even though they gave him sleep medication and all that. It still didn't work for him.
Well, it doesn't work. Sleep medication doesn't create good sleep. It makes you unconscious. And that's a big misnomer, I think, a big misunderstanding. So, you know, if you look at, there's a study on, I think it was the Benadryl, the drug in Benadryl. And people took that, you know, it's basically the sleep aid version of the over-the-counter ones. And if I think I've got the drug right, in the study where they compared shift workers to people that took that every single night, they both had the much lower life expectancy because both of them were experiencing sleep disruption. So just because you're prescribed a medication that makes you close your eyes doesn't mean you're actually getting the quality of sleep that you need.
Yeah, unfortunately that he wasn't sleeping and he was just beside himself. You know, he was very frustrated with the way his life was turning out. I mean, here he was broken. Obviously, to me, he had PTSD from everything that has happened the last few years. And now he's dealing with not sleeping, hopelessness and everything else, feeling like his world is just crashing down on him. He was just done. He was exhausted. And he did tell me he didn't want to wish what he had on anyone else.
Prior to that, had he ever talked about calls that bothered him?
Not really, no. He kept that separate.
Because I think, really, I mean, my career, for example, I had, you know, I mean, I was a, what they call a black cloud. So I seemed to get a lot of the shitty calls, never had a cardiac arrest save in 14 years. I was just that guy. But there was never really one call that bothered me. There was one I can think of with a child that, you know, if you asked me what was one of the worst things, it would be that one. But it wasn't like I really had an issue with it. I had a little kind of mini flashback once. One single time in Disney years ago when someone pushed a stroller and looked exactly the way the kid was in this car. But what I think a lot of us do suffer from is the death by a thousand cuts. It's not the one thing, it's the cumulative, you know, element of all the things. And I only had 14 years, so Frank had more than double my career.
Yeah, he did mention one call before. It was also like a teenager, but he made it PG-13 version. You know, so it wasn't as like gory or anything like that. He just kind of like washed over it and he went to this call and the kid didn't make it. So that's how he would talk to me about some of the calls, the tragic calls that he would get sometimes. Or he would just say, oh, it was just a hard shift. I just need to sleep and stuff. So he'd never, he was the type of guy that would just carry it within himself and find ways on how to deal with it and not bother me or make me worry about his calls. Even though I'll be like, how is work? Do you want to talk about anything? He just pretty much kept that life separated from the personal stuff.
So what about the tools that you and the, and your kids use to navigate out of this horrendous loss of your husband slash father? What were some of the things that you leaned into? You said that you had, you know, everyone come surround you as far as a family. Did you right. find other counseling, therapies, sports, anything else that really helped?
Yes. So right after Frank passed away, obviously, we went to therapy. And then my kids went to therapy. I went to therapy. Then the insurance hits because we were under his insurance. And at the time, you know, I did Cobra for like a few months, but it became very expensive, right? Because Cobra is private insurance. I had to get my own insurance. Unfortunately, the insurance, the private insurance that I purchased for my children and I did not cover behavioral health. So therapy wasn't even included. So I tried to reach out to different resources. Thankfully, here where we live, the school had a therapy, I guess you can, like a services. And, you know, my son did go. And initially, he's like, okay, I'll go try it out, whatever. He went and they're like, okay, he seems to be handling it well. And I don't want my son to be forced to go to therapy because to me, if I see him handling it well, and they say that he's handling it well, I don't want him to have a bad taste in his mouth being forced to go to therapy. I want therapy to be as a tool that it's okay to go to therapy, but it's not forced or mandatory. So they went to therapy for a little bit. So did my daughter. And then she's like, I don't think I need it because at the time she's already 20. And, you know, she's also was going to school for psychology as her major. And she's like, and she's level-headed. Thankfully, our children are level-headed. And I could also see that they were handling their grief really well. They're very strong and very courageous. And I think they're very resilient. So I was like, okay, as long as I have a good pulse on how they're behaving and how they're handling their grief, then we're good. As far as for me, I had to do a lot of inner work. So I sat with my grief and I let my grief become my friend. For quite a while, for like about a year. Right after Frank passed, I started going back to training because Frank did jiu-jitsu. I also did a little bit of jiu-jitsu, but I'm not a competitor like him. I just do it as a workout. So I started going back to jiu-jitsu just to train and stuff. And, you know, to me, movement is therapy. So I feel like I got more out of that than seeing an actual therapist, but I did, you know, I would see a therapist like once a month or every other month or so, but it wasn't as consistent as going back on the mats and training.
Yeah, no, it's funny you said about the children. That's how my son was after that whole debacle. We took him to counseling because it was, you know, completely detrimental, and he just he didn't want to be there. You know, we didn't force it upon him. We just kind of, you know, showed him that this is available for you. He didn't connect with the counselor, and that was it. But, you know, he leans into his sports. He went into running. Now he's big into skimboarding. So he's off. He's 16 now. So he'll drive to the beach almost every weekend and spend, you know, 3 or 4 hours on his own, just trying to break his neck on the sand. So, yeah, I mean, that's a really, really important part of that, I think, is just kind of like we're talking about with the therapies that, you know, sadly weren't as evident and available to Frank when he mostly needed them. But the toolbox that's available to us is much wider than we think. And we go to someone in a traditional medical route, of which, of course, there are some great practitioners out there. But more often than not, it's going to be talk therapy and psychiatric meds are the two main options. But also outside of that, everything, as we touched on, from psychedelics and, you know, and ketamine, which obviously even now today, everyone can get ketamine therapy if you find the right place, because it is legal because of anesthesia. But then you've also got equine therapy and diving and surfing retreats and all these things. So there's so many other ways that you are still actively pursuing your mental health. You just don't need to sit on a couch and talk about your family. But that might also be an invaluable part of that whole process.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, like, I think we have this old stigma of therapy is a traditional therapy of going to just the office and sitting there and talking about stuff, when all in all, really, it's therapy when it's making you feel good. And if it's making you feel like, okay, you're releasing some of the stress that's inside of you, whether it's through movement, whether it's through painting, art, you know, or cooking or anything like that, that is therapy. And unfortunately, like, people don't talk about that. It's not being, we're not being educated about the different ways how we can help, I guess, de-stress and take care of our mental health through those options.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of that, like you said, you know, I hear this phrase all the time, people did the best with what they had at the time. And I think that's a very fair statement. You know, how we think about mental health in 2024 is very different than 2014 even. You know, I think my journey into this began around then, when we started having suicides and they were finally being spoken about. As we sit here today, though, what are you hoping that fire departments listening will do as far as creating change and improving the environment so maybe we can catch the next one who's falling?
My ideal world, quote unquote, I wish that, you know, fire departments will have their own behavioral and wellness department within a department, right? They should create a team of behavioral and wellness. And instead of playing triage, why don't we play preventative measures, put programs in place for these first responders or, you know, firefighters, EMS guys, and like have them go attend a workshop, have them attend some kind of, I guess, like retreat, anything, something where you know how to deal with stress, that you can debrief after a tragic fall, or even if it's not really tragic, if it just triggered you in some capacity, there should be like a number or maybe just a safe space or a person within that department or in that little team that you can go to, and that's completely confidential and private, and you can just speak to that person or a team, or if it's like a two team or whatever, is speak to them about it and not have to worry about stigma, not have to worry about, oh my gosh, if someone in admin finds out about this, I might lose my job or they're going to count that against me. So I think they need to create that kind of, I guess, I don't know if it's a department, but something like that. Does that make sense?
No, it does. It does. And it's good that in your area around Sunrise, they have the Florida Firefighter Safety and Health Collaborative. And that organization, which started from departments, you know, all over Central Florida and South Florida, have created a number of initiatives. They have Red Line Rescue, which is a kind of network of peer support from all over the I think it's certainly the state. So for example, if you're a Miami firefighter, but you don't want to speak to someone from your area, you can, you know, find a firefighter in Jacksonville and talk to them. But they've also got this initiative where they're training counselors to become culturally competent. So they actually go through classes, they do ride-alongs, they start to understand what our shift work looks like, you know, how we talk, you know, all these kind of things that then will make a responder comfortable when they walk in and they already know, you know, what they do for a living. So I think, you know, that's what's encouraging is if you are in, for example, your area, you have an incredible resource, you know, right next to you. And this is a group that's being, you know, questioned by people all over the country because they're doing so well. So, you know, I hope if they haven't already that, you know, Sunrise and neighboring departments will reach out to those guys because you don't have to reinvent the wheel. They've got it figured out. And if you're, you know, Davie and some of these smaller cities, they may not have the capacity to have an entire mental health branch. So then you form a coalition and let's say, you know, three cities get together and one of them, they all chip in and they create one for the three cities. When I worked in Anaheim, we had what's called NorthNet, and it was Anaheim, City of Orange, Fullerton, a couple of others. And we trained together and we did a whole bunch of things together. Well, that's the same with this. You know, if you're not big enough, then share mental health resources, but make a change, make it happen. Because the biggest thing that I see is the barrier to entry. The most courageous thing a first responder can do is say, I need help. But absolutely. The question is, have you created a road from I need help to actually getting help, and not just any help, getting the right help, not the EAP Russian roulette that I hear of so often?
Yeah, I hear that the peer support, the EAP, it's like being scuffed upon or, you know, looked down on because they're like, it's a joke from what I hear. So yeah, obviously that's not working. So what you're saying sounds like a brilliant idea. And I do think that, yeah, if it's too expensive for one city, for one department to do that, why not form a coalition and, you know, get that set up, get that started, because it is okay to not be okay. And this job is really, really tough on your mental health. You've got to have the right support and you shouldn't be stigmatized or penalized for asking for help or, you know, going through the process of getting help. Because you want to serve other people as well, not or being forced to retire or resign or, you know, leave the department because you're having a mental health crisis. It should be protected until such time when, okay, this person really, they're done and they don't want to do it or whatever, then that's fine. But if they're going through, if they are in the midst of a crisis, please, let's not discard them. They're not dispensable because we are dealing with someone's life here and how it can affect them eventually down the road.
One thing I've said a lot recently, you know, if you hired someone and they slipped through the net, especially at the moment with the recruiting crisis that we have, and they were terrible from day one and now they're terrible in year two, that's a different conversation. But if you had someone like Frank and so many of these others that you ask them, what were you like in their first year? Oh, they were amazing. They were always laughing and joking. They would cook. They would, and then you can compare that to now. Well, that's what's happened to them. How come we got here? And, you know, like you said, if Sunrise was well staffed, then, you know, that's phenomenal. And I don't know, do they have Kelly days in Sunrise?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. So you're 48-hour work week. So that's still room for improvement. I would love to see the entire nation do a 24/72 as a standard so we can get more rest and recovery and time home for our responders. But also, we've got to have that compassionate eye is, you know, when you see and do what we do, it is going to take a piece of us. I mean, how can it not? So the best thing that we can do is try and offset that with the rest, recovery, you know, the mental health support, removing the barriers to entry, so that we can, you know, not just get them when they're broken, but keep kind of, you know, putting them back together again when they just get chipped a little bit, you know, the maintenance rather than the crisis. But more often than not, and it's such a contrast to the military system is not perfect, and I've heard many horror stories, but at least they have a healthcare system that takes care of them during and after they retire. As you mentioned, you're a first responder. The moment you retire, you have COBRA, which basically no one can afford for a year, and then nothing. So 30 years of wear and tear and emotional trauma, and then you just kind of chucked out the bag. So we as a profession have to advocate for not only our own health, but the health of our family, because how we are then obviously directly impacts the people that we love.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I just hope that, you know, basing off what happened to Frank, that a lot more changes are being put upon, like, you know, and it just, I just don't want the same thing to happen to anyone at all. And that at the end of the day, they're still a human being. And, you know, there's a lot more than what you see in the front. And that, like I said, I understand where everyone was coming from, but it could have been dealt better.
Yeah. Well, and again, like we said at the beginning, this is the beautiful opportunity now, rather than just shrugging our shoulders and go, oh, well, which I see a lot, not saying that was the case in here particularly, but, or you can go, that was horrendous. We can't bring that person back, but we can sure as hell learn from it and make sure it doesn't happen again, or at least, should I say, reduce the chances of it happening again. Of course, you can't save everyone, but try and save as many as you can.
And I do think the department, his department, has put some parameters in place into, you know, making sure that they don't make the same mistake that they did with Frank. And, you know, they're honoring him as well. We did the Kagan's Climb on March 29 of 2024. And it was such, I was so humbled and grateful for the outpouring of support, because it was a last minute event, and the amount of people that showed up, you know, to support us, to memorialize Frank, Captain Frank Kagan, was so humbling. It was amazing. So we're hoping that next year we're going to get the word out, and that these departments, other departments, will come and join us and really, you know, put it in the limelight, put it in the forefront right there about mental health amongst the first responders, and tell everyone it's okay to not be okay, that there's resources, and that let's do better. Let's find more things, or put together more programs for these first responders, right? And keep exploring different options and how we can help them and reduce the risk of suicide, reduce the risk of our first responders feeling discarded after a mental health crisis.
Absolutely. Well, I want to end on, you know, a high note. Talk to me about what Kayla and Frankie are doing now.
Well, Kayla's graduating from FSU this summer with a bachelor's in psychology and a minor in criminology. She's applying to be a licensed mental health counselor, so she's trying to get her master's degree in that at FIU, keeping her fingers crossed. And Frankie is actually a fire explorer for the city of Sunrise. So he's, let's just say he's dabbling on that idea of possibly, perhaps, you know, going towards the path of the fire department, and maybe perhaps just like his father. But I mean, he's only 16, he'll be 17. You know, whatever he wants to do, I fully support it, as long as he's passionate about it and he's going to be a good person and he does well and he's a productive member of the society, I'm all for it. But it's amazing to see him, you know, take that up, because I do believe that after Frank passed away, or even when Frank was going through the crisis, he did have a different opinion when it came to the brotherhood of the fire department. He felt that, you know, his dad was abandoned and betrayed by his brothers and sisters, and that they were not there for him. And his perspective did change after the memorial climb a month ago. And right after the climb, he became interested. He saw how everyone pulled through in a matter of less than a week to be there for his dad. And that's when he started the Fire Explorer program immediately.
Beautiful. Well, that underlines one point that I'll kind of close with. You know, they say that we're, you know, very good at burying our own. We're just not good at preventing the deaths. And, you know, people say that the brotherhood and sisterhood is dead. I disagree. You know, you go to memorial events like that and you see it. You go to the 343 Hero Challenge that I do in Florida every year. You'll see that as well. But I think the shift has to be made that we've got to put that same camaraderie in the prevention side, in advocating for the work week that actually is healthy for us, for staffing so that you don't get mandatory and kept from your family again, for, you know, the resources, as you said, to be in-house or at least completely accessible so that when people need it, they can go. It's not, you know, because a peer support is basically just friends checking on friends. That's fantastic, but they're really just the gateway to the actual therapy that you need as well. So I think, you know, seeing that camaraderie, seeing Frankie's faith restored in the fire service is beautiful. But now we have to do it so that the Frankies of, you know, the next generation that joins the fire service, that we create a different fire service that allows him to thrive rather than decay.
Absolutely. And that's what I'm hoping for, you know, moving forward now. Let's create this path. Let's create some kind of momentum of destigmatizing mental health in the first responder community. We need to speak more about it. It's very uncomfortable for people to talk about it because it feels like, oh, such a heavy burden, or it's such a loaded word, and that you're weak because you're struggling with your mental health, right? No, everyone struggles. It's just the more we push it down, the worse it gets. But if there are resources and if you see people reaching out for help, then it becomes okay because we're talking more about it. It becomes normalized. And I do hope that, you know, the fire department and police departments, I hope that they make it more as a normal thing to go get help, get resources, and just talk about mental health in general as just like anything else, like high blood pressure.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure that, you know, there are a lot of people listening that have moved. I'm sure there's a lot of people that work with Frank that probably, you know, have enjoyed hearing some of the kind of, you know, the reminiscent memories that you talked about. If people want to reach out to you, where are the best places to find you online?
My daughter and I are starting, we're going to put together and we're going to start a nonprofit organization called Kagan's Climb. So she had started a Facebook page and an Instagram page, and they can reach me there, or they can also email us over there as well, direct message. They can also reach me on my email, which is Bethel2001@gmail.com if they want to reach out to me and talk more and explore other options and how we can go about just spreading awareness. I think that's the most important thing for me, is to spread awareness and, you know, destigmatize suicide and mental illness and mental health.
Absolutely. Well, Bethel, I want to thank you so much. And as I always say, you know, when people are revisiting traumas like this, I know that it's kind of, you know, pulling the scab off the wound a little bit, but there is also so much good that comes from hearing a story like this, especially when it's so raw. I mean, you're talking 2 years ago. So I want to thank you not only for your courageous vulnerability, but for also being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast to tell Frank's story.
Thank you so much, James. And what you're doing, you're opening doors, or actually ears, eyes, whatever you want to call it, for everyone, you know, to hear all these different stories from different people, right? And I appreciate it. And thank you. I'm so humbled to be a part of this show. And like I said, this is a brand new chapter for me. I've never been on a podcast. I was never the type to be like speaking in front of other people and making speeches and stuff. And now it seems like this is the path where I'm starting to go and travel. And I'm hoping that, you know, through this platform that I can reach other people as well and help other people. And, you know, they need anything, like any help at all, if they want someone to talk to, that there's resources available, and never, ever feel embarrassed or ashamed that they're struggling.